Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. He tells a joke every Monday morning. We also have the Monday morning movie reviews and some box office to talk about. We're going to play a little catch-up. When I was not on this past week ago on Monday, so we're going to play a little bit of catch-up here. On some of the movies, but we got the new ones to talk about as well. Also, the Emmys were handed out last night. I watched the show. If you guys watched it, we want to hear from you. We've got some award show scandals that we're going to talk about and things you never knew about the Emmys, and we'll talk about the show and the winners and all the surprises. Lots of surprises last night on the Emmys. So we will get to all of that right here. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text and all that good stuff. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week to discuss the new movies and review the movies, and then Eric sticks around and we do the box office as well. So let's get these guys on. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Thank you.
And Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hey. I think this is the first time in a long time the three of us have been on together.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
since
you're
August,
right.
Actually. Yeah, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, it feels like it's been a long time. Well, we're here. We're all
yay.
Here. All right, we'll play a little catch-up from last week.
Yeah.
Steve, tell everybody about Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice.
Oh, happily. I just sort of recently rediscovered my childhood love of the music of Linda Ronstadt. I got a couple greatest hit CDs and a deluxe edition of the Trio album or recordings, and then there was a live album that just came out. And then so it's perfect that this documentary has come out that traces her life from sort of childhood and singing very popular Mexican songs with her very musical family, and then her years being a diverse recording artist, and sort of how today how she's adjusted to a life without any public singing since Parkinson's disease began impacting her voice several years ago. I think her last concert was like 2009. The film is directed, this is called The Sound of My Voice, and the film is directed by these two very talented documentary filmmakers. I guess they make features too, but Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, who did either together or separately did like the Oscar-winning The Times of Harvey Milk and The Celluloid Closet. The film frames Ronstadt in a very different light than I think other recent films about singer-songwriters, since she wasn't a songwriter. Instead, her gift, aside from her flawless, versatile voice, was finding the perfect songs to fit her vocal abilities. And often these were lesser-known gems that she and her various collaborators and bandmates would polish and rearrange and send out into the world as perfect pop rock creations. And it goes through her whole career, obviously, starting as a member of a band called the Stone Ponies with the song Different Drum, which was like kind of life-changing for a lot of, especially female singers. And then she quickly moved on as a solo artist, and her first band basically became the Eagles, which is, you know, everybody knows that story, but it's still kind of great to hear it in this. And there's no reason to go through like the list of great songs that she made famous, but thanks to a combination of like archival interviews and more substantial recent interviews with her, she's basically able to sort of narrate her own story, which is I think a real important thing. The documentary explains very clearly why she became one of the biggest female rock acts of all time, and certainly the biggest one through a big chunk of the 70s. And then in an industry that was certainly completely dominated by men, she also helped out a lot of female singers, a lot of like Emmylou Harris, her trio's partner, tells a great story about how she kind of pulled her out from despair after Graham Parsons died and sort of encouraged her to do her own music. The film covers a little bit of her personal life, including her longtime relationship with the musician J.D. Souther, and then, of course, her headline-making romance with Catherine California Governor Jerry Brown, but thankfully they don't really linger on that, and they kind of stick to the music. And far more detail is paid to some of the stuff she did after her rock career, including, you know, operatic musical theater with Pirates of Penzance, which they made into a movie, and then she did a standards collection with Nelson Riddle, and like I said, the Trios album with Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton. She did Spanish language recordings, basically forays into every imaginable musical genre. I think one of the most jaw-dropping moments in the film is when we see her today, and we see her, she's in her early 70s, and she's singing harmony with a pair of family members on some of these Mexican folk songs that she loves, and her voice sounds lovely, and I think it drives home a point that the film makes, which is that she didn't stop singing because she couldn't sing, which is the way it was reported by a lot of people. She stopped singing because it wasn't perfect anymore, and she was a true perfectionist when it came to the presentation of her music, and that point is driven home repeatedly in this film. And without that sort of defining vocal range that she used to have, she wasn't interested in being a part of the conversation anymore. And that's a beautiful decision that she made, and empowering and inspiring and a little sad. I'm not only recommending The Sound of My Voice, I think it's important to sort of see it in a theater featuring the best possible sound system, because if they crank it right, it just sounds amazing in a big theater. The live performances really pop, in particular, when you see it that way. So, you know, she was a musical pioneer, a very vocal activist for all manner of human rights, and a damn fine person. And the film kind of captures it all beautifully. So I am definitely recommending it.
Oh, I think it's one of the best movies of the year. It's really, really great. I happen to be a really big Linda Ronstadt fan, I think, as most people are. And this is just all-encompassing. It really is. It's complete. It's really well done. You know, the talking heads are great. The people that mm-hmm. she's worked with in the past are great. And her story is terrific. And it's told really, really beautifully in this. And like you, Steve, I was under the impression that she can't sing anymore.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty amazing moment in the film. This is a woman who deserves a documentary made about her pioneering female vocalist, and you know, her impact on music is immeasurable. And and this is a really, really great tribute to her. I think everybody should see it, especially if you're a fan of Linda Ronstadt, because this mm-hmm. is just this is a great movie. It's a terrific, terrific movie. These guys make good films.
Yeah,
as seen in Friedman, they make really good movies. And this is only playing in three theaters. It's playing at the ArcLight in Chicago. It's playing at the Landmark on Clark, and at the Century in Evanston. Mm-hmm. And I would go out of my way to see it. It's an absolutely terrific film. So, all right. Catching up on last week, Eric, tell us about Hustlers.
Okay. Well, this is based on, I think it was a Vanity Fair article about a true story about a group of strippers who basically sort of turned the tables on the people that they were entertaining. The movie stars Constance Wu, as one of these women who basically comes under the tutelage of Jennifer Lopez's sort of more world-weary dancer, if you will. They form a friendship, and, you know, we sort of get, you know, the basic story of what, you know, what strip clubs are and the people that patron them and whatnot, and what the Jennifer Lopez's character basically concocts is the idea that we have all these rich Wall Street guys coming in and having their jollies and everything that, you know, when they give them their credit cards, they can then max them out to as much as they can and, you know, take the cash, and they all get rich off of it. And when the guys go to complain, well, what are they going to do? You're going to reverse the charge in a strip club? What bank is going to do that? You get kind of a cadre of dancers together, and they're all basically doing this, particularly you know, for a while it's going pretty good, but the economy crashes in 2007, 2008, and things, they have to start kind of taking things to another level and actually going out and recruiting people to come into the strip clubs and then stealing them, so, you know, taking them for all they're worth and whatnot. Okay, so this film, which I ended up seeing in Toronto, was written and directed by Lorraine Scafaria, who directed a very underrated film, I think, called Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. And a second film called The Meddler with Susan Sarandon and Rose Byrne that I was not as crazy about. And I'm even less crazy about this film. After I saw it in Toronto, my first reaction to the movie was that this is basically drama for the Real Housewives crowd. It's kind of big and flashy. The costumes are great. The personalities are big and bold and these kind of things. But the characters themselves are not particularly that interesting, and as the movie goes on, even less likable. When this movie, early on, when this movie should be having a lot more fun than it actually is, and as Julia Stiles, who plays the journalist in the movie that Constance Wu was telling her story to, says at one point, you know, as far as the Wall Street guys are concerned, I don't really care if they get ripped off. And that's a sentiment that most viewers will probably have. But that doesn't last very long in the movie. It happens, it occurs very early. A lot of these guys get ripped off. You don't mind them seeing get ripped off. But while the women are having fun, the film itself, you know, doesn't seem to be having a whole lot of fun. At least it wasn't sort of, I certainly wasn't. And then, you know, the movie then takes a turn where they're not really just ripping off the Wall Street people. They're ripping off a bunch of schlubs and whatnot. And there's no real great style to the film.
Eric, hang on one second, okay?
Okay.
We got to take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll find out what Eric thought of the rest of it, Hustlers. We'll find out what Steve thought of it, and I'll tell you what I thought of it, too. Catching up a little bit from last week, and then we'll jump into the new movies right here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And it is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. The Emmys were handed out last night. We'll go through all of that. And then we got things that you never knew about the Emmys and award show scandals from the past. By the way, tomorrow on the show, our good friend Dan Feinberg is going to join us from Hollywood Reporter, TV critic, and he joins us every couple of weeks. But we want to get his thoughts on the Emmys, and we will talk about that even more. Right now, though, we are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. And, so we've got Eric was just telling us about Hustlers, and let's get Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay. All right, Eric, continue. Hustlers.
Okay. So as I was saying, the movie, while I thought it wasn't very fun when it should be having fun, when it starts to get a little bit more serious, you start sort of shifting your loyalties a little bit, you know, particularly, you know, amongst the women, not alone the fact that some of the guys that they begin to take later in the movie are not quite as deserving of what happens to them compared to these Wall Street guy jerks that they're dealing with. And then I think the movie kind of embarrassingly tries to bring in ham-fistedly bring in kind of an irony to the Me Too movement involved in what the guys are being screwed out of their money. I thought that was handled very poorly. The setup of the movie, I think, is done in such a way that, I mean, if you miss the first 2-3 minutes of the movie, you basically miss all this movie really has to say about the downside of being a professional dancer, or at least someone who does it on the side trying to make a little bit of money. The movie doesn't really have that kind of struggle that you would normally see in a typical movie or a typical story. Jennifer Lopez's character is very well off. Constance Wu is doing stuff for her grandmother. Well, they don't seem to be that penniless, even without the money. You know, I don't know, people touting Jennifer Lopez for an Oscar nomination for this movie, I think, are on a new special breed of crack that I haven't been witness to yet. And I found the last line of the movie particularly embarrassing. And I don't know what people are seeing in this movie, other than a lot of big personalities, Jennifer Lopez, and, you know, her extraordinary figure that is, you know, brought into play very early in the film. And I don't know. I walked out of this movie, found it to be incredibly mediocre.
Wow. Okay. All right. Steve, what about you?
I love this movie. I don't know. I mean, flat is like the last word I would use to describe it, really. I mean, it's high energy. It's like a raging soundtrack. It's splashy and colorful. And like Eric said, there's like an array of beautiful women in all shapes, sizes, and colors. And it's a kind of crazy, wonderful combination. I thought it was funny. I thought the way it gets a little more serious in the back, or like in the last third maybe, really kind of sealed it for me, because it was acknowledging that, like, okay, yeah, crime does pay sometimes, until like the weak link in your little scheme kind of breaks down and gives you all up. But I mean, the film is definitely more than Jennifer Lopez in a G-string, although, you know, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's here. There's messages about empowerment here and how dumb and manipulatable men can be, and we probably don't need to be reminded of that. We know, but then, yeah, like I said, like there is, I don't know if it's the line you're talking about, Eric, but there is a line that Jennifer Lopez delivers about how the world is like a strip club. Is that
the
one you're talking about? Oh yeah, no, that's way too. That was bad, but it's not like, and certainly unnecessary. But I don't think it undercuts.
It's the final line of the movie.
No, I know, but I don't think it. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I don't think that it's the final line. The movie doesn't undercut everything that has come before it. It's totally unnecessary. Like we got that already. We figured that out on our own. I get it, but it's more just underscoring something rather than erasing everything. So. And I, you know, honestly, it was also kind of instructional in the beginning, where Constance Wu was kind of learning to up her game as a dancer. Watching Jennifer Lopez give her pole dancing lessons is impressive. I mean, I feel like I walked out of there thinking I could do it a little better. Don't move if I needed to. So, no, but I mean, I mean, Lorraine Scafaria has this really wonderful gift of sort of giving a crap about the characters and before the laughs or the drama or whatever it is she's going after in whatever movie she's making, she really does want to get us into the heads of these characters a little bit. And I think she achieves that, but I just thought it was also really fun. And after, I don't even know how many years and how many films I've watched where the role of stripper is essentially relegated to the background of a scene that usually is about men being men. It's kind of nice to see that they're not being treated like wallpaper anymore. And it's not like striptease or showgirls either. It's a very, like, attention is given to the lives of these women, and it's almost borderline unprecedented to a certain degree. But I don't think this is a film that's just important. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it just because I thought it was important. I actually think it was a real blast to watch. So,
yeah, I'm with you, Steve. I thought it was terrific. I really, and I'm not a Jennifer Lopez fan at all, but I think she's really terrific in this movie. And man, she's 50 years old. Her, you know, the pole work stuff is impressive. I mean, she's in great shape, man. I liked Constance Wu a lot in it. I liked her story. I liked the camaraderie between the women. I think it's really, really fun to watch and flashy, as you guys said. And as the movie chugged along, I was even more with it as the complications arose throughout the movie. And you know, I think this is one of Jennifer Lopez's best performances. And I'm not a big fan, like I said, but. Let me just say this really quickly. It was a delight to see Mercedes Rule back on the big screen. That just made me very happy. And also Julia Stiles. She doesn't work very often.
Yeah.
So to see these two women, who I admire greatly, really have some fun, you know, with the role, especially Mercedes Rule. She's a blast in it. And I liked all the characters. I thought it was an interesting story, and I thought it was well handled. And yeah, so I found it to be a really entertaining film. That I really, really, really liked a lot. So, All right. Well, let's move on to this week. All right, Steve, tell us about villains.
Oh, boy. Okay, let's see. It's been a while since I've seen it, so I'm working from memory here. What I remember about it is about a pair of amateur criminals that I think the film begins where they attempt a gas station robbery that kind of goes sideways, and I forget the money, is that what happens, or something? They drive away without something that they actually went there for, and they're not only amateurs, they're idiots, and they end up at the breaking into the what they think is an empty suburban home, and they are starting to like case the place, and they stumble upon something kind of crazy in the basement, and eventually the homeowners come back, and they're played by I should say the two criminals are played by Micah Monroe and Bill Skarsgård, and they're adorable together. They're very charming, even if they are idiots. But the older couple that arrives at the house, the homeowners are Jeffrey Donovan and Kira Sedgwick. From what I remember, I was a little put off by the performances by the older characters. I thought it was a little over the top, a little too sort of overly Southern polite. It reminded me of something John Waters might have tried a while ago, or did try a while ago, and I think he did it better when it was maybe not so much of a cliche at the time, but I was so sort of charmed by the predicament of the younger couple, and the weird thing is that the overall vibe of the whole thing is fun and lighthearted, even though it's sadistic and sometimes very violent, and the things we're finding out about the older couple are kind of weird and nasty sometimes. It actually has a stranger a vibe that you would not expect from it. I guess you could also read messages into the film about morality and class divisions and kicking aside traditional family unit, but it really seemed like the purpose was fun, and if that's your only criteria, villains will probably work for you. I don't think I was as shocked by some of the things that were supposed to be shocking here. Maybe I'm just desensitized to sadistic behavior on film these days. I don't know. But, well, when we get to another movie we're going to talk about later, I was not desensitized to it. But yeah, I mean, there's not a lot new here, but I think there's stuff to like, and so I'd consider this a mild recommendation.
Okay. Eric, hang on. We're going to find out what you thought of it afterwards, okay?
Okay,
so Eric and Steve are here. We'll take a quick break. We're talking about the movie Villains, and we'll find out what Eric Childress thought of it right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago here until 5 o'clock. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We're going to go through the Emmys, which were handed out last night, and we got award show scandals that we're going to get to as well. Right now, though, it's our weekly meeting with Eric and Steve, where we review all the movies on the Monday morning movie reviews, and then Eric will stick around and we'll talk box office as well. Before the break, Steve told us about a movie called Villains, and Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
And Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
Eric, you also saw Villains. Where do you stand on this one?
I did. I'm not recommending this either. This is another movie that I think kind of falls into the same category that I think it thinks it's having more fun than it's actually sort of projecting to the audience. I mean, the two leads in the movie, and this is, you know, kind of a classic kind of genre setup with two, you know, anti-heroes go into a place and then, you know, an even worse place, and then we have to root for them even harder. And, you know, I agree with Steve that, you know, the performances by Jeffrey Donovan, an actor I've never really cared for, actually, and Kira Sedgwick, are just not that, you know, they're overly broad. Is like they seem to know, like, we have to put on a show here, so let's just try to be as clowny and as over the top as possible, but still within some limit of reality. And it just never, that element never really works. There's like brief moments here and there throughout the film. I think the setup, works pretty well. I like the Monroe and Skarsgård, but there's one moment involving sort of the requisition of, I believe, a tongue ring that I think is the kind of stuff that I was hoping to see more of in the movie, that the movie was going to at least be sort of over the top in, you know, the manner in which they were going to have to try to get away from these characters. And the movie just never really figures out, you know, how to really sort of broaden the expanse of this movie. I mean, it's more or less kind of a one set type of story, and it just never really kind of got past its setup for me. I can't quite recommend it.
Okay, so that's Villains, playing at a couple of theaters. All right, Eric, tell us about Zeroville.
Okay, well, this is the latest directorial effort from James Franco, who I think has directed like 30 movies.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah,
it's pretty crazy. I mean, that's almost as much as Steven Spielberg has made, and James Franco has only been directing for maybe a decade or so. But this is based on a novel by Steve Erickson from 2007. It's a story of a young guy who's nicknamed Vickers, played by James Franco, who is in his 20s. He's a big movie fan. The movie, I believe, the story is set in like late 60s, like 1968-69, and he goes to Hollywood. He's got a tattoo on the back of his bald head from a scene from A Place in the Sun of Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor, and he ends up ingratiating himself into the Hollywood scene of that time. And while a lot of names are not used, none that I can remember anyway, we basically get personalities that we can go, hey, I know who that person is. That person's talking about a movie, you know, set in Martha's Vineyard about a shark. I think I know who that character is. So he ends up getting a job as a film editor, and becoming infatuated with an actress played by Megan Fox. The movie just kind of becomes this episodic, freewheeling kind of thing, as he is shown to be a very good editor, but basically runs afoul of a couple bigwigs in the business. One played by Seth Rogen, who is more or less playing John Milius, and seems to be working on Apocalypse Now, at the time. And another studio executive played by Will Ferrell. Both of them playing, again, to the hilt, if you will. James Franco playing it very, level-headed, and Megan Fox is the object of lust throughout the story. Other than the Disaster Artist, I challenge anyone to think of a James Franco movie that is worth exploring one time, let alone a second time. And this one certainly falls into that category as well. Pretension is just all over this thing, as in most Franco productions. Clearly, he's got some interest in this book. This movie's been held up since 2014, when the studio that backed him went bankrupt. And now, coincidentally, 5 years later, right on the heels of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, this movie finally comes out. I think Seth Rogen is probably the best thing in the movie, doing his Amelius type impersonation. Will Ferrell is ridiculous, but if you want to see him be a lot more funnier, watch Between Two Ferns on Netflix. This came out this weekend. The longer the movie goes on, there are some really potentially interesting things that I assume were probably explored further in the book. The idea that the character, the DeFranco character, who might kind of be autistic in a way, and he sees movies through a different lens, and believes that they found a secret movie that's actually like hidden one frame at a time in all these different movies that have all been made. Like, I want to see that movie. I'd love to see a greater exploration of something like that, but this is just a bunch of, you know, friends of Franco doing him a favor again, and you know not cheating him. You know, a lot of people in this movie are doing their thing, including Rogan and Farrell and Craig Robinson, but the movie itself is just so overly pretentious and ultimately just kind of like stupid, that it's just like, what, it's just such a waste of so much talent on a project that just never has any focus whatsoever.
Okay. All right, Steve, what about you?
Yeah, pretension is the theme of this movie, I think. It feels unfinished, like it's a first draft, which I'm guessing that's because the script was probably a first draft, or assuming there was one. There's like a strange sort of energy and enthusiasm that I always get from Franco-directed things, and in certain cases, like The Disaster Artist, I think it works wonderfully. Here, it's strange to me because I think he's sort of failing miserably to capture a weirdness of this book and of this story. I think he set out to make a movie that was weird and surreal, and it's like the label is stamped on the frame, but it's not actually that. And I also think that, like, I can't imagine like genuine cinephiles getting much out of this, because it doesn't exactly dig deep for his reference points or influences or whatever. I also can't imagine casual moviegoers caring much about this either, exactly because of the pretentious tone of the characters or the movie. I mean, if you want to see most of the cast of The Disaster Artist and This Is the End, two movies I really loved together in one movie, this is your one-stop shop. But man, I think one of the only like sort of smaller parts that worked for me was seeing Dave Franco show up at the end as sort of the ghost of Montgomery Clift, because my God, does he look like him? And I think it's just a really nice scene, because it kind of slows down a little bit and gives us a little bit of a peek into Vickers' mind. But this is like right near the beginning of the film, there's a statement that is repeated throughout the film. I think I can say F continuity. That's basically what it is. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh boy, here we go. Because they keep saying it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, now we're in trouble. And half the time you can't even tell what year it is. Like, it's, there are like huge time jumps of many years. Because I think it ends up like in the early 80s or something. And
yeah, it does. And Raging Bull is out. Yeah, because Raging Bull is out by the end of the movie.
Right, because they mentioned Raging Bull. So, like, but the idea that, and I don't think it's, and Eric's right, it's not a coincidence that the opening scene is in 1969, and he's literally arrested as a suspect in the Sharon Tate murder. So, I mean, it is that sort of Tarantino-style thing of intersecting reality with fiction, and, man, this is how you do it, and it goes wrong. But like I said, there is, like, a weird energy to it, and certainly he loves making these movies, and this is actually, I think, shot before The Disaster Artist, so yeah, this has been on the shelf for a while, and, I mean, I'm glad I saw it just to, you know, to keep up with some of these actors were doing a few years ago. But beyond that, I can't imagine anyone liking this.
Okay. All right. Guys, hang out, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Eric and Steve are here. We're going to come back and review more new movies right here on 720 WGN.
Some that you recognize. Some
Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and we are going to talk about the Emmys from last night and some other award show scandals and things like that. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Monday morning movie reviews, that's what we're doing right now. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week. And let's get the guys back on. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, so Steve, tell us about Jay Myself.
Oh, sure. This is the title of this documentary is actually about. It came from a mishearing of the name of the subject, whose name is actually Jay Mizell. And for some reason that just really charmed me, and it just made me very interested to know, okay, why would they do that? And it amused me to such a degree that I actually got really invested in the long and impressive life of this grumpy, world-renowned photographer who is known by a lot of people because back in 1969, once again, in New York, he bought a six-story, 37,000 square foot former bank and used it as his home and studio. He bought it for a song and then just sort of filled each of the, I think it's 72 rooms in this place with collected objects, as well as his own sort of photos and slides, although most of it are sort of these curated rooms of similar objects, similar shapes, similar themes, however, whatever he wanted, basically. It was all in his head, and he just sort of put it out there. The film is directed by another photographer and a fellow intern of Mizell's named Stephen Wilkes, and he catches up with at the time in 2015 when the film was made, Mizell was 88. And it was costing him too much money, shockingly, in New York City, although it was in the Bowery, which is now fully, just completely modernized and there's nothing scary about it anymore, but right. Gentrified, that's what I'm looking for. And so he can't live there anymore because he can't afford like the property taxes and all that. So he's moving out to another location, although it's still very big. But it's giving them a reason to kind of go through every room and disassemble everything. And Mizell is being, it gives him a chance to reflect it's actually very moving to everyone except maybe Mizell, who is sort of just more fascinated than anything at what he used to do or what he collected, and he's taking pictures the whole time to document it, and he just sort of always sees every situation as a photography opportunity. Sometimes he takes apart objects that we're familiar with and then arranges them in pieces in these sort of new and interesting ways. He's kind of like a hoarder with a more detail-oriented mind. And he's sort of inventing this collection, and there's a really funny moment where someone opens up a drawer in a desk and sees like, a couple hundred screws that are all exactly the same. And someone's like, can I take one? He goes, no, because that would ruin the collection. And a collection that only he knows about and cares about and wouldn't notice if it disappeared. But because someone asked him, he said no. So, this is the way the guy, but it's fascinating. It's hilarious. In the last few years, there have been a few documentaries about sort of older New Yorkers, very often creative types, living in these landmark buildings or have to relocate for whatever reason. And the cumulative effect of these movies is both sort of melancholy and captivating. You can't help but be amazed by the objects these people have amassed over their lifetime. And a lot of times they've been there for decades. And especially creative types, they just have the most fascinating collections of stuff. And to see it, in this case, it's not just collections. It's not just like he's stacking stuff in a room. He's arranging it. He's like he's making it look aesthetically nice. They do cover his career a little bit, like a brief history, and I love that he sort of sums up his entire style of photography as, hey, look, and that's it. And the more we see of his work, the more sort of awestruck we are by it, and he literally has thousands of photos just taken from the windows, the many, many windows of this building. They might even be collected in a book. I think it's kind of famous, but over decades again. And somehow all of humanity is represented in those photos. And, you know, he's a lovable curmudgeon, and I feel fortunate to have discovered him through this film and this beautifully sort of deconstructive process. And the film's playing at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
Okay, just Jay myself. All right, cool. All right, Steve, you're the only one who saw Downton Abbey.
The number one movie of the week?
It's what? Yeah, you're the only one who saw it, although I was shocked by the numbers. I got to tell you, I was really, we'll get to the box office in a little bit, but I did not expect it to make over $30 million. My God. So, all right, tell us about Downton Abbey.
I mean, it's kind of difficult for me to imagine someone without a working knowledge of the wildly popular PBS drama Downton Abbey, what they would think of a big screen version. But it's also almost equally impossible for me to believe that someone wouldn't be swept up in some aspect of it, whether it's the elegance or the charm or the humor or the intrigue of this, of the Crowley family and their small army of servants who prove integral to the success of both the estate and the film. It's set in a home in which class, and I say that with a capital C, is sort of built into the foundation of the building. It may be tough for more modern eyes to get past the idea that being a servant was considered a noble, even enviable position in a certain day and age in England. But since Downton Abbey was always a show that strove for historical accuracy above all else, it would be sort of disingenuous to portray it any other way. So I think that's fairly accurate. The series sort of tended to be more serious and soap opera-ish, and the film has sort of opted for a little bit more of a lighthearted tone, even perhaps in an effort to make it more accessible to people who don't know the series. It's written by the series creator Julian Fellowes and directed by someone who frequently directed episodes, Michael Engler. And they sort of just drop us in on a typical day in the estate that I think is set about a year and a half after the last episode, or the last episode was, I think, 2015. And it's a typical day, and then it's immediately interrupted when a letter from Buckingham Palace shows up announcing that the King and Queen of England are going to be coming to Downton Abbey, popping in on their way to another destination. And by, when I say King and Queen, by the way, this is King George the Fifth and Queen Mary, not the current Queen. Not surprisingly, because of this news, the house is sent into a tizzy, and both upstairs and downstairs. What's important to know about the series, and I think that the movie continues this, is that the showrunners never sort of favored the masters or the servants in terms of the amount of time it spent telling the story. So everyone was treated equally in terms of screen time. And so we're sort of caught up on all these lives. And the film does a wonderful job of sort of dropping us in, just updating us a little bit, maybe even, you know, giving some of the characters a turn in terms of their fortunes or whatever, or maybe there is none. Maybe it's just a little bit of an update. For example, the patriarch of the family, Robert, played by Hugh Bonneville, is sort of wondering if it's even worth it keeping such a huge estate together anymore, and he's thinking about selling it or selling pieces of it off. He's been transitioning control of Downton Abbey to his daughter Mary, who's played by Michelle Dockery, and even she seems less than sure that she wants this life for herself. You know, everyone comes back for the most part. There's even a few people that have left the show that came back, and as always, with the series, the most relatable character on the show is a character named Tom Branson, who's played by Alan Leach, who, Irish-born former chauffeur who married the youngest daughter, who then ended up, she died in childbirth, but he's still around, and he sort of provides the family with this sort of grounded element. In a lot of ways, he's our entry point into this opulence, and he's always been the most fascinating character, and that is doubly so in this movie. What the staff doesn't realize about this royal visit is that the king and queen are preceded by their own battalion of butlers and ladies-in-waiting and chefs who all basically push out the existing staff, which, of course, doesn't sit well with anybody, and they take steps to make sure that doesn't quite happen. Imelda Staunton shows up as a sort of a distant relative, and she's a really nice addition who it works with the queen, but also happens to hold the power to determine whether Robert is the rightful heir to a great deal of the family fortune. And she seems determined that he isn't, and it led to a big rift in the family. And so she's there, and they're sort of trying to work that out. There weren't really any bad guys in Downton Abbey, unless you count like a would-be royal assassin who barely even registers in this story. But there aren't any. They don't really have any major turns for the worse for any of the characters. Like I said, they were trying to keep things, I think, a little lighter. The film basically feels like a keepsake for longtime fans who just want to know that their favorite characters are doing all right. And I don't know if there are plans to do more, but I kind of hope they do every couple years just so I know what everyone's up to. But if not, I think they kind of leave it on a high note. And I, you know, am eager to see what happens next. But if this is it, that's great. I think it's a terrific film.
Okay, cool. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve are here, and we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We've got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
Yeah. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to recap the Emmys and talk a little bit more about award shows in general. And the movie reviews are happening right now. Steve and Eric join me every Monday morning for the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, tell us about Ad Astra.
Okay, this is the new science fiction film from James Gray. Stars Brad Pitt as a guy that, as the movie begins, he is working on this, this sort of extraordinary antenna that goes from the Earth just about into space when sort of a power surge that has been linked deep within space nearly kills him. And, in fact, does kill tens of thousands of people on Earth. He is later briefed by the military that a old project known as the Lima Project that was based put in motion many years ago to look for further intelligent life in the universe, that the surge that's causing all the havoc may be coming from this particular base set up around Neptune. To further complicate matters, the founder or the person in charge of that project was Pitt's father, played by Tommy Lee Jones. So the military is asking him to go take a ride to the moon. Moon travel has actually been commercialized at this point. There are even subways on the moon, the sandwich shop, not actual trains. And not to then go from the moon to Mars, to where they want him to transmit a personal message to try to reach out to his father to find out whether or not he is actually purposely putting forth the surge that is happening, or if it's just something that is occurring naturally. So we have this sort of big sort of interstellar space adventure on the horizon, but actually one that is far more introspective, more along the lines of 2001 than, say, Gravity. Pitt's character, who narrates the film, is, you know, really, you know, kind of wrestling with the fact that he has just found out that his father is may actually still be alive, someone he has thought has been dead for many years, and now not just that, maybe they're personally responsible for the deaths of several people in the universe. So wrestling with this knowledge and the fact that he has a uncanny knack for having a heart rate that never gets above 80 beats per second is quite a thing, or 80 beats per minute, excuse me. That'd be quite an accomplishment.
It would be impressive.
Yeah. It would, yeah. So he's very, very level-headed, very even-keeled, has to go through these tests, if people saw Blade Runner 2049 and saw what Ryan Gosling had to go through, very sort of similar, except tests for humans in this film, and wrestling with this the entire way, and this movie really kind of takes us not just to the depths of space, but really sort of the depths of our own souls, particularly the soul of this character, and I think it does so in a really special way. This film is not, while it does have action sequences, there is a moon chase and guns and a bunch of things that occurred through this thing. It's not exactly what you would call an action-packed science fiction story. Like you said, this is a much more introspective film about the search for father, the search for one's father, so some say the search for God, the idea that God may have, may be out to destroy what he has created, and wrestling with that, and just all kinds of things that sons deal with their fathers, absentee fathers, and this movie really kind of started to hit me in a very personal way. I think Brad Pitt gives one of his very best performances, and that's saying something coming, just off of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. There's a scene, about halfway through this movie when he's recording this message where he just kind of goes off script for a moment, and I think it's one of the best scenes that Brad Pitt has ever played in his entire career, which is, a pretty remarkable feat in that as well. And, this movie looks beautiful. The score is really lovely, but never intrusive. I think that ultimately where this film goes, I think is fascinating. And it's a movie that, again, it hit me on a very personal level. I found this movie never boring in any stretch, always something to sort of wrap your mind around, and it really had me thinking quite a bit for pretty much all weekend since I've seen the movie. I'm very much looking forward to seeing it again and having further discussions about it, because I think it's really one of the special movies of the year.
Okay. All right, what'd you think, Steve?
Yeah, he's right. This is definitely like a conversation starter, and the more I've thought about it since I saw it, the more like questions I have, and not because the film is confusing or isn't complete. It's meant to generate questions. It's meant to because obviously at first I was like, wait, I was sort of found myself searching for moments where I could penetrate Brad Pitt's character's like mind a little bit, which is ironic because he's constantly taking psychological tests, so we should know. But we also get a sense that he's sort of manipulating those in the same way he manipulates his heartbeat. And at first I'm like, haven't they figured this out? And I'm like, oh wait, maybe they have figured this out. And they're using it. He's the last person that should go on this mission for many reasons. And I think that's intentional, and I won't even go into why I think it's intentional, because I don't want to spoil anything about when he actually gets to Neptune. But, I don't think I'm the only person that's come up with this, but certainly it jumped out at me while I watched it. This is basically a modern telling of Apocalypse Now, or Heart of Darkness, however you want to look at it. Where he's being told about this mission initially, they're putting down photos of his father, like he doesn't know what his father looks like. So I'm like, that is exactly like Apocalypse Now. And then he kind of makes all these little stops along the way to get to Neptune, and something really interesting happens in each place, including like a really kind of shocking and terrifying sequence where they find this spaceship that's in distress. And I was not expecting that at all. And even sometimes the action almost seems unnecessary and a little bit like window dressing, but at the same time, I loved it. Like, I thought it was terrific. And yeah, Pitt's performance is very different than what he does in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Here, this is a kid who was sort of grown, like he was sort of a born to be a hero, and he's the son of a hero, and as opposed to this character that he played before, was the guy who's sort of happy to be in the background to a certain degree and not get recognized and stuff. But so, you know, it's a really, like, the cinematography is stunning. I think it's actually by a guy that had worked with Nolan on a couple films fairly recently. And the result is, like, like Eric said, a really gripping performance by Brad Pitt. And we should say that, like, you should view this on the biggest screen possible, because I can't imagine it looking good small. and I admire it even more, like, the more I think of it. I admire it more than I think I love it, but I still really am recommending it highly. So, okay. Yeah, that's my...
All right. For Complications, I didn't get a chance to see it this week. But I'm really looking forward to it. I hope it, it sounds really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We're going to take one more break, and then we'll come back and review a couple more movies, including another Rambo movie. You guys hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Eric and Steve are here. We're going to take a quick break, and we got more movies to review right after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And yeah, we're going to recap the Emmys and talk about other award shows and all that cool stuff. Movie reviews are continuing. Steve and Eric join me every Monday morning for the movie reviews, and then Eric will stick around and we'll do some box office figures as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Steve, tell us about American Dreamer.
Ah, okay. So Jim Gaffigan's in a lot of movies, especially this year. I think I've seen him. I see him in 5 movies this year so far, and I know he's in at least 1 or 2 more probably before the end of the year. He also comes to Chicago a lot because he was just here last week for this movie, and he was also at the Chicago Critics Film Festival for a different movie. So in American Dreamer, he plays a down-on-his-luck rideshare driver named Cam, who makes a little extra, well, probably a lot of extra cash, chauffeuring around a low-level drug dealer around town, and he... he just realizes, like, he's in a situation in his life, as we find out, that he's lost his job, he's lost his wife and kid, he doesn't even have access to his kid anymore because his life is such a mess, and he has no money, and he owes them a lot of money. And so he comes up with this sort of half-baked plan to kidnap the dealer's infant child and then sort of ask for ransom money, thinking he won't get found out. And needless to say, the plan goes sideways almost instantly. And by the end of the film, some truly tragic stuff happens, all of which is Cam's fault completely. And weirdly enough, by the end of the film, he hasn't, and I don't think I'm ruining anything by saying this, he really doesn't pay for any of what he does in the end, which may be a comment on how white guys can basically get away with anything. I don't know. That's what it feels like. But I'm not even sure the director, co-writer, whose name is Derek Borte, I don't think he was really thinking it through to that degree, but it's sort of what it feels like. Like I said, Gaffigan's been in a ton of movies lately, and I'm genuinely been impressed with his sort of shifting range as an actor. But his performance in this movie, it seems like the character is designed to lose him fans. I mean, it's a really serious movie. There's nothing funny about it. I want to make sure that's clear. It's not trying to be funny, and it's not funny. He's kind of an obnoxious, pathetic human being that we're never even really allowed to feel sorry for on any level, despite all these things kind of crippling him. They're all of his making. It's not introspective enough to feel like a Taxi Driver ripoff, even. But it does capture some of that claustrophobia that comes with this particular job and sort of just living this perpetually miserable life. The film isn't especially political, but it does feel like there's a little bit of commentary floating around the perimeters about economics plight and the way cops probably wouldn't even look sideways at someone that looks like him, that looks like Cam, when considering where all the criminals in the world might be. The film is sort of short enough to not hurt too much. It has a moment or two in the acting department and story department that are interesting, but being on VOD, because I don't think it's in any theaters right now, but being on VOD is exactly where this needed to land. So I'm not particularly recommending American Dreamer unless you're a Jim Gaffigan completist.
I watched it on the VOD over the weekend, and it's a massive departure for him, and I think he's really good in it, actually.
And again
it's, you know, this is not you're not covering any new ground here, and he's a completely unlikable character who is at the center of every, you know, of the entire movie. But it has some really strong moments, and a lot of them have to do with Gaffigan. I think Gaffigan's really, really quite good in this. I mean, there's nothing wholly original about it. We've seen this kind of movie before. You know, it owes to a lot of other movies and better movies. You mentioned Taxi Driver and things like that. But it's got you know, I mean, I was pretty compelled by the, you know, watching the whole thing. I was reasonably compelled, and most of that has to do with Gaffigan. And again, if you're a Jim Gaffigan fan, this is not the Jim Gaffigan that you. not the Jim Gaffigan that you know or love. There's nothing funny in this movie, and he's a real bastard. And he plays it really, really well. I was surprised at how effective he is in this role. And I'm a fan of Gaffigan. I think he's great, and I love his stand up. And I just think he's great persona. And he has been in 53 movies, over the past like 2 months. But I think his performance in this one kind of stands out above some of the other movies that he's made. It's not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination. Again, you're not covering any new ground, but I think it's worth seeing just because of him. I think he's really great in it. So
I can't go that quite that far, but I can say he is very good in it. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Eric. Rambo, man.
Last Blood.
Last Blood, baby.
That's right. Okay. So, it's been 11 years since the last Rambo movie, properly titled Rambo. And at the end of that one, we saw him, John Rambo, finally get to go home. I guess it turned out to be his father's horse ranch, or something like that. And as the movie opens, that's where we find him. That, you know, he's out there, doing Roy Rogers routines on horses and, has built, elaborate tunnels. On the property. I don't know if he built them himself or his father built them, but they're there. And even as a guy that has extreme PTSD, seems to like to go down in them a lot and build weapons and stuff. But he's not there alone. He lives there with a friend of his, played by Adriana Barraza, is there and helps him out on the ranch. She has a granddaughter that is, you know, kind of more or less become like John Rambo's daughter herself. And she has been doing some research on her father, and a friend of hers down in Mexico. They actually live in the ranches in Arizona. Has tracked down her father that she hasn't seen in years, and she would very much like to go and see him and reconnect with him. But John Rambo knows her father and knows that he is a really terrible human being. Things didn't work out very well between him and the mother, and he just warns her, you want no part of this because he's a really bad guy. But being a teenager as she is, she can't help but go down to Mexico, where her friend introduces her. Things just don't go well with the father, and next thing you know, she is being kidnapped by a group of human traffickers in Mexico. John goes down to find out what happened to her when she doesn't come home, and he gets tangled up with the human traffickers himself, and it's eventually going to lead to what you expect out of a Rambo movie, a giant mano-a-mano between John Rambo and an entire army, pretty much. Okay, so the Rambo character, you know, to say that, you know, the Rambo character has become a cartoon, and this is nowhere where we were from John Rambo in First Blood back in 1982. You know, we've gone down that argument before. He's been a cartoon pretty much since, you know, the mid-80s when Rambo First Blood Part 2 was a big success. But, you know, one thing you can say about the John Rambo character of the 80s in those three movies is that the Rambo character was at least sort of representation of some part of America. You know, 1982, he was a Vietnam vet coming home and wasn't really wanted anymore. In 1985, it was the Vietnam vet who was going to correct the mistake of the Vietnam War and bring back our boys. And then in 1988, it was America getting involved in the Russian-Afghanistan conflict. So at least, you know, those three movies you could say something about, and then when he brought the character back 20 years later, it was just, you know, an excuse to blow up people with a giant shotgun. With Rambo Last Blood, which runs all of 78 minutes before the end credits, which then give us a recap of the first, all movies, actually, right up to the fifth movie gives us a recap of that as well. There's certainly not much to this movie. I'm not quite going down the road just how ugly things get in this movie. There is violence in this movie that shocked even me. And I went in with the attitude that that's exactly what I was going in for. I wanted to see Rambo blow up some human traffickers with his shotgun and, you know, hopefully feel good about it. But there's a moment early in the movie where he does something to a guy in a car that I almost was recoiling in my seat. I could not believe what I was witnessing. And then right up to the, you know, the big confrontation at the end, what he does to one of the people at the very end, I'm like, is he really going to do? yeah. So, and then, you know, sort of everything sort of in between is just kind of reduced to, you know, almost like, note cards on a script board. You know, it just seemed like that's all that's written out, and as much as detail as you can get on those note cards, that's what's going to end up in the final print. And that's what it kind of feels like. There's not a lot of build up, to the stuff that's from the moment we meet the human traffickers to the commando like, closure, and, you know, that's all I wanted was those last 10-15 minutes to really sort of, you know, like, okay, that's exactly what I wanted out of this movie. But even that goes by pretty quickly, as gruesome as the carnage gets.
Okay, and Eric, some of it Eric, hang on.
Okay.
All right, we got to take a break, and we'll wrap it up here. Eric and Steve and I will tell you what we thought of Rambo Last Blood right after we get back from this, right here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we're here until 5 a.m. Yeah. Yeah, and Eric and Steve join me every Monday to talk movies, and let's get Eric was telling us about Rambo Last Blood. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, continue, Eric.
Yeah, so I was saying, like, you know, getting up to the ultimate carnage of the climax of the movie, that's kind of all I really wanted to get out of this movie. But even that, with the exception of, the kills are, spectacular, and, if that's the kind of thing you're looking for, but it kind of goes by so quickly. It's not a well-directed film by any sleight of the imagination. And I actually watched a good bit of the last Rambo movie, which Stallone did. And quality issues aside, that movie delivered exactly what I wanted out of the climax and is actually a much better directed film. Like you said, this movie is just kind of, it's in fits and spurts. What happens and ends up happening to the teenage girl in this movie is really kind of ugly and depressing. The movie doesn't have anything, anything interesting to say about human, not that you can, is anything interesting to say about human traffickers, but they're just cartoon characters, basically. And they're just meant to be as horrific and awful as possible. And yeah, that's exactly what we want to think about human traffickers. But they insert a character played by Paz Vega, who is completely wasted in this movie as this journalist who's just kind of hopping around bars trying to get a story about this group, and she has a personal connection, personal tragic connection to them as well. The movie kind of blows by those scenes because Rambo just seems to threaten anyone that comes between him and the traffickers. So ultimately, it was very unsatisfying by the end of it. I think that this character deserves better, even if even in a cartoon form. As a weird side note to the release of this movie, internationally, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's actually a longer cut that's being seen by international audiences right now, and not just in a MPAA kind of trim back or scale back the violence kind of way. There's actually like an entire opening prologue that we didn't get here in the States. That actually, it's just kind of another action sequence, him rescuing some lost hikers, and I think it's basically to show that he's, like, really good with local cops now, as opposed to back in 1982. But that scene is completely gone, and actually has a bit of dialogue, I understand, that sets up one of the final shots of the movie. But we didn't get that here in the U.S. We got a 78-minute version of Rambo Last Blood. And unfortunately, if there's going to be any more like this, if this is what we have to look forward to, I'm kind of glad that it is The Last Blood.
Okay. All right. Steve, what'd you think?
Yeah, I actually would have liked to have seen that scene just to see how life was with the cops after the first one. So, there is a weird sense in the beginning of this film that he has sort of turned a corner. I think they're almost trying to fool us into thinking that maybe he's not the same guy he was. And in fact, when he first confronts the traffickers, they just level him. Like, they just brutalize him the first time, and you're like, oh, this is different. But he has even one of the best lines in the film is near the beginning, where the adopted daughter says, oh, people change, you change. And he said, well, I didn't change, I just kind of put a lid on it. And that's your first sense that maybe not everything's fixed. I'm sure I wasn't the only one that looked at those tunnels and went, gee, I wonder if this is going to come back into play later. So I completely agree with what Eric said. And it in addition to just like being these human traffickers, they're Mexican human traffickers, and they're like the worst people on the planet. I'm sure this film will be on repeat in the White House screening room, the same way like First Blood Part 2 was probably on repeat in the Reagan White House. But man, This movie is kind of reprehensible in the way it portrays most of the Mexican characters. And I'm not someone that gets particularly politically correct about much when it comes to movie watching, but it really just struck me. And having Paz Vega's character, who I actually thought was a nice addition, I wish they'd found a way to keep her in it. I feel like that's saying, oh, there's some good Mexican too, but I'm like, oh, that's it. The movie's kind of gross in that respect. So by the time we get to those last like 20 minutes or so, which are like the bloodiest installment of the Home Alone franchise that I've ever seen. There's this like booby traps and he's hiding around corners. I'm pretty sure there's even a scene where he cuts a guy's head off and then shoots him. Well, I could be wrong, but that's what I seem to remember in my head. He kills just about everybody twice. And honestly, yeah, Eric's right. That's what you signed up for. That's what you paid money for. To see if it would go there again, and it certainly does. And you can't say you can't be disappointed by the action in it. I hope it is the last chapter because this feels like something that should be gone. That's probably a good thing. It certainly has its moments, like I said, but I'm more torn than I'm probably letting on about how I feel about this, but I guess the ending sold me a little bit, so I'm a little more positive than Eric, but just barely.
Okay. This pretty much was exactly what I was expecting. I mean, you go to see these movies so you can see Stallone kill everybody, yeah. And he certainly does that to a monstrous degree. Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole the plot itself is you know, barely there. But I mean, you know, the idea is that you go and see these Rambo movies because you want to see Stallone kill people, and he does that. He does that a lot in this movie, and yeah, it is like really, really short and barely exists. But there are quality kills in this movie. I'm gonna tell you, man.
It's like a horror movie. Is worse than most horror movies.
Yeah, no, and you know these last two Rambo movies have been insanely violent. I mean, you know the first three are violent. Well, the first, you know, here's the deal. I try to separate the first movie from the rest of them because the first movie is a legitimately good film, and I think First Blood is terrific, and I think it's his best performance. I think it's Stallone's best performance. I've always been a really, really huge fan of First Blood, and as the movies have gone on, they've gotten really sillier, and this is as ridiculous a movie as you can possibly imagine. But hey, he kills everybody, and that's what I wanted to see. So, not a great recommendation, but if you want to see Stallone kill a bunch of people, he kills a bunch of people. So, and in very, very gruesome fashion.
Yeah,
so, yeah. I would just recommend just people show up for like the last 15 minutes. Then,
yeah. No, I mean, that's
you need to even sit through the first hour of the movie.
No, that's the big. You know, the last 15, 20 minutes is the big payoff. There's no question about it. It's I mean, that's why I went. All right, what do we got next week? Just Abominable.
That's the only major release opening next week.
I think Judy opens next week too. That's sort of half major.
Oh, right. Okay, that's the Judy Garland movie with Renee Zellweger. Okay. All right, Steve. Thank you, man.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks.
There you go. There's Steve. And Eric, let's talk box office.
Okay.
My God, Downton Abbey. Did anybody see this coming? $31 million.
No. No one really saw this coming.
It beat a Brad Pitt movie, and it beat a Rambo movie by a lot.
Yeah. No, when I went to the theater on Friday afternoon to see both Pitt and Rambo. I mean, seriously, they're like Downton Abbey must have just been letting out because it was like the entire like senior day. Seriously, was letting out of the theater. I'm just like the theater was abnormally packed for a Friday afternoon, and everyone was going to see the matinees of Downton Abbey.
Yeah,
obviously, and I mean, like, again, the initial projections on this were in like 11, 12 million.
Yeah,
and then earlier this week they kind of got close to double. They were saying like 19 to 24 million. And I didn't quite know. I mean, because my biggest thing was, you know, why I didn't know where this movie was going to land, not because of the fan base. I know it has a big fan base, but I was thinking, one, are they going to show up for it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a few years since, you know, that series ended. Are they going to show up for it, or are they just going to wait for it to, you know, show up on, you know, cable or DVD or whatever? And Focus Features, not exactly known for big, you know, huge releases. They've only had a few over the years.
Yeah.
And this is the biggest opening they've ever had. The biggest opening they ever had as in their history was Insidious Chapter 3.
Wow.
With $22.6 million.
Wow.
So this is, blew this out of the water. And now this has a chance now to beat the all-time grosser, at least domestically, which was Brokeback Mountain.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, Ad Astra, $19.2 million. Is that about what was expected?
Yeah, this is pretty good. I mean, pretty much, you know, somewhere in the high teens, maybe the low 20s, people were sort of expecting for this one. It's not a terrible opening. Opened higher than First Man did last year.
Yeah.
For comparing astronaut movies. This one, I think, is going to drop a lot further because
right.
I think most people are not going to know what to make of this movie.
Right.
And this movie cost conservatively $80 million. There was reshoots on it. So the cost on this one is probably a lot higher. So
right. It's
really going to take a big international haul to make this into a profit.
All right. We're pretty much out of time, but Rambo made $19 million. It Chapter 2 is and number 5 is Hustlers. So that's
yeah.
it. So we're looking at that. Abominable will be in number 1 next week?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's a safe bet.
Okay. All right, Eric. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, man.
There you go. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every week to talk movies. All right, we're going to take a break here on 720 WGN.